Hi, and welcome to episode number 9 of the History of Liberalism. My name is Felix, and I hope you will enjoy what you're about to hear. Today, we're going to talk about three men who had a great impact on the evolution of liberalism, pre and post French Revolution. The first of these is David Hume. Hume is quite a tricky fellow. He's not a main character in this story, not really, but is always present in the outskirts. He objected to the also important notion of natural rights and the ability to form rational judgment. And also, he knew everyone. And by everyone, it seems I mean literally everyone. So I'm going to talk real quick about Hume. David Hume was born in 1711 in Edinburgh, Scotland. He went to university at a very young age. Apparently, the normal thing to do back then was to start at 14, but Hume was only about 12. So he was pretty smart. He studied philosophy and would spend his life writing and contemplating philosophical problems. When he was 28, he published his first major work, A Treatise of Human Nature. Today, it's considered a masterpiece, but at the time of the publication, it was pretty much scoffed at. However, this did not stop him from keep writing. In the mid-1740s, he started amassing a huge book, The History of England, eventually more than 1 million words long. In comparison, we can mention that The Lord of the Rings is about 500,000 words. That said, Hume was apparently capable of writing short stuff too. For example, he wrote an autobiography in just 5 pages. Eventually, Hume published his book and it turned out to be a bestseller. But enough about the man and on to his thoughts. Hume was skeptical about the rational man and thought that earlier thinkers had overestimated man's ability to embrace rational thinking. To understand Hume, we must first understand what he calls perceptions. Perceptions are everything we experience, the taste of an apple, the sound of running water, etc. Perceptions are all there is in our mind. Hume goes on to say that there are two types of perceptions, impressions and ideas. Impressions are more hands-on stuff, like the taste of an apple we are eating in this very moment. Ideas are what it sounds like, ideas or recollections, maybe a memory of the taste of an apple. So ideas are simply past impressions. Basically everything we know because of impressions. Because we have experienced it. This has implications on morals. Hume says he's disappointed in all earlier writers' attempts to study morals. They all begin in a good fashion with this is and that is, but at one point or another, without explaining how and why, they transition into this ought to be. Morals are not directed by reason, they are simply passions based on impressions. There is no objective moral. The same goes for reason, so he's somehow relativistic when it comes to morals and reasons. There are no right or wrongs. If I prefer to watch the world burn rather than cut my finger, well, then I'm not a worse person or a more irrational person than if my preferences were the other way around. Hume exemplifies this by asking us to imagine a cold-blooded murder, an evil act one must admit. But he then asks us to examine all the evidence. All we can find are certain motives, passions, thoughts and acts. We do not find evil, whatever that is. In order to do that, we must turn to ourselves and into our hearts, where we feel that the act committed must be evil. This in turn means that reason can give us no guidance to what is right or wrong. And boom, just like that, Hume dealt a severe blow to the contract-based theories of Hume and Locke. With that, it is time to leave Scotland and get over to Germany. We're gonna meet Immanuel Kant, who was a fantastic man. He was born in 1724 in Königsberg in Germany, and he died in the same city 79 years later. I read a long time ago that during this time, the furthest away from Königsberg Kant came was like 15 kilometers. As this sounded too good to be true, I consulted Wikipedia, and it turned out that this was probably just a myth. In reality, or at least probably, Kant at one time traveled as far as the city of Gross Arnsdorf in what today is Poland, that is 150 kilometers. So apparently Kant could be a little crazy. It is also said that one could set one's watch after Kant. Such a scheduled life did he lead, taking his walks at precisely the same hour every day. Other than that, what can I tell you? He never married, and he apparently never left town, so he didn't really do much, except on paper. Cause all that time he saved, not marrying and not traveling, he spent writing. So he did a lot of that. And he was very, very successful. Kant was a great thinker. However, when it came to politics at least, he wasn't the most original one. His political ideas were in many cases but a mixture of ideas learned from different sources. No, what originality he showed when it came to politics was in the basis of the ideas. The main difference between Kant and the likes of Locke was that while Locke claimed that man was born a blank page, slowly filled by impressions from the world, Kant claimed that some ideas were with us a priori, from birth. That is how we know something is right. It is imprinted in us from birth. So according to Kant, there is a difference between what we want to do and what we ought to do. Or at least there could be. Hence, he agreed with Rousseau. Freedom is not only the lack of things stopping us to do stuff. It is being sensible enough to do what we ought to do and not only what we want to do. From this, he derived his categorical imperative, a simple saying that really originates in the Bible, but in more than one sense it's just common sense. We should act according to that maxim whereby we can, at the same time, will that it should become universal law. Apply this to the state, and you should get a state that allows for pluralism, as it should be very restrictive when it comes to legislation. Other than that, his political ideas was very much focused on peace between nations and how to achieve this. Kant saw war as the natural state between states. Peace was something that had to be achieved. For this to be possible, states need republicanism. By that he means a state founded on the principle of its members' freedom, and by members he meant citizens. The citizens of a state also needed to be subjected by one set of laws, and the laws had to be applied equally to everyone. Kant said that there were only two ways to run a state, in accordance with republicanism or despotism. Republicanism manifested itself by separating the executive power from the legislative power. In a despotic state, no such separation exists. What Kant did here was highlighting something important. A republic, a term used for a long time for a certain type of government, was misused. The kind of government did not matter. What mattered was how the state was run. And therefore, he redefined what a republic was. So Kant's idea was really that the type of government did not really matter. And this is an idea we will get back to in a later episode when we talk about the spread of democracy. However, now we have to move on to the last guy in this episode, Alexis de Tocqueville, a man who did a lot to study the phenomenon of democracy. Tocqueville was born in 1805 in a noble French family. I'm not quite sure how he did it, but he was probably very well connected through his family. However it came about, he went on several state-sponsored trips from the early 1830s and onward. The most famous was in 1831, when he crossed the pond, but he later went on to England, Ireland, and Algeria. He also got involved in politics. However, he did this during very turbulent times. In 1848, there was a revolution in France, not even close to being as bloody as the revolution 60 years earlier. It was still an upheaval. What followed was the short-lived Second Republic, in which Tocqueville got the honor of serving as Minister of Foreign Affairs, if only for a couple of months. He died of tuberculosis in 1859, but left a legacy of one of the earliest and greatest theorists of democracy. It is said that Churchill once said that democracy is the worst form of government, except for every other form of government. Tocqueville would probably have understood him. Tocqueville's masterpiece is his Democracy in America, in which he analyzes democracy with all its faults and shortcomings. Tocqueville went to America in 1831, and he stayed there for 10 months, officially sent there by the French state to study their prison system. 10 months. Even back then, 10 months was plenty of time. But as Tocqueville had a much, much grander mission in mind, 10 months was nothing. He spent but 4 days in Washington and did not meet any of the important people of this period. All he did for 10 months was rush around trying to experience as much as possible of the young nation. Back in France, he wrote Democracy in America. Because of all the rushing around, his book is pretty much a theoretical work stripped by more hands-on episodes. But that's really the only negative thing you can say about it. The main topic of Democracy in America is, of course, what he saw and learned. But he's not simply reporting it, he's trying to understand what it means and what France could learn from it. Tocqueville was no naive guy. He understood that just because something was good for America, the same something might not be good for France. Okay, so let's have a closer look on what Tocqueville wrote. Tocqueville did not start with a single man in the state of nature. No, he started with investigating the social conditions of America. So he's a pretty practical guy. In many ways, his book seems to urge men on, telling them to make the best of the lot awarded them by God. In this, equality and democracy are very important. Democracy and equality are potentially great things, but they are also potentially terrifying. They might spell freedom, as in America, or they might spell doom, as in the revolutionary France. It is up to man to decide which it's gonna be. This is hard to stress enough. Tocqueville saw democracy not only as good, but as potentially ruinous. Democracy is characterized by atomism. All the strings that attached one man to the rest of the society in the society of old are cut off. All men are equal, each independent, each impotent. So Tocqueville saw it as a very important mission for the democratic state to create artificial bonds of the same type as the society of old. In short, society needed to provide men with a reason for caring about society. For in the new democratic society, each man is the center of his own universe. Sure, there are other people there, family and close friends. But that does not a society make. In such a world, men tend to focus too much on their own comfort and their own material standing, and too little on the society as a whole. Hence, a society comprised of men like these tend to drift into despotism. Public virtue must be restored. The state must step up its game and provide some material comfort or something in return for men to sacrifice time and energy in the public sphere. However, things will get even more tricky. For in the democracy, the way to satisfaction of material desires lay open, but not just to me or you, but to everyone. The competition soon grows fierce, and no matter how much I manage to grab, there will always be more that I did not manage to grab, and so my appetite for material well-being grows. Commerce is great, but commerce is dangerous. Before you know it, all the best men of the nation is engaged in it, in effect a brain drain from politics. And these guys are the new nobles if you give them half a finger. However, there are two things that works against this. In the democratic society where men are equal, men will quickly identify that they have a lot in common. And because of that, I wish no harm to come to my neighbor, as my neighbor is just like me. So what we have is a society populated with self-interested but compassionate men. Good, you say. Indeed, Tocqueville answers, but warns that compassion and self-interest sometimes clash. Sure, you will help your neighbor, of course you will, but there's a limit. You wouldn't save your neighbor from starving to death by giving him the bread that keeps you from starving to death. So democracy has some potential, but it's also got some problems. Or in Tocqueville's own words, democracy loosens social ties, but tightens natural ones. It brings kindred more closely together, while it throws citizens more apart. Let's go back to the founding principle of democracy, equality. Men in a democracy just loves equality. However, according to Tocqueville, this can express itself in two ways. A manly and lawful passion for equality, by which he meant the aim to raise everyone to the level of greatness, or a depraved taste for equality, which strives to drag everyone down to the same lousy level of life. And this is a real problem, as in truth, not everyone can be raised to the level of greatness, which angers pretty much everyone. The great ones held back by the mediocre, and the mediocre taunted by the great, which is why men begin to think maybe it would be a good idea to surrender some of that freedom in order to achieve equality. The state is waiting for this. It's the one player that can liberate men from their freedom and in turn provide some equality. Sure, this is despotism, but a benign version. And really, it is what we all live with today. Me in Sweden, a little more so than the rest of you, but we all have surrendered some of our freedoms in order for some cushy equality. Tocqueville is not blind to the real problem of this, the tyranny of the majority. It is really a wonderful picture he paints about why a democratic society is dragged down to mediocrity. Men are born gifted with great and not so great minds. The men with the best minds will be in the minority. However, the power of the majority is strong, so strong that expressing or even holding an opinion that are not shared by the majority will be a very painful thing indeed. And the real loss is that the majority's inferior thoughts will prevail. Sort of the same problem arises when it comes to money. The wealthy will always be in a minority. However, this troubles Tocqueville less, as he believes that the middle class will grow and grow strong in a democratic society, so that the majority will not be the rich nor the poor, but the middle class. And these guys will keep the economic balance in society. Okay, so we have spent a good deal of time talking about this problem of democracy by now. So what was Tocqueville? The Noam Chomsky of his day? No, not by a long shot. Tocqueville did have plenty of ideas on how to remedy this problem. The first and foremost was local democracy. Of this, he saw plenty in America. By pushing decisions to a local level, the federal state made people feel included. Voting for who should be the sheriff in your town achieves two things. It did make you care about who was the sheriff, and it made you feel you were participating in shaping society. The last thing here is important. It is the seed of what is called public virtue. Care on a local level, and chances are that you sooner or later care on a national level. Tocqueville also pointed to the freedom of associations as a super important thing in a democracy. Remember, each man is free but impotent. Well, by joining together, men were not as impotent anymore. Sure, there are dangers with this, but the potential good outweighs the dangers 10-1. By and by, Tocqueville was much impressed by what he saw in America and thought that no, Europe couldn't straight up copy it, but that did not mean that Europe did not have a lot to learn. And, as you know, Europe would rather learn than copy from America. I'm not sure you're hearing this, but outside my window there are kids playing and a dog is barking, so I think it's time to go for this time. But before I do, I just want to remind you that if you want to, feel free to send me an email at historyofliberalismpodcast@gmail.com, visit historyofliberalism.wordpress.com, or you can find me at Twitter at Age of Liberalism. Until next week, have a good one.